In the next short piece of film footage, you're going to see this film footage is from buildings, and you'll hear loud bangs. Watch the blacks. The blacks are also running at times. Watch how they flee. And I'm not sure if the police are using tear gas, but they're at least using rubber bullets. And so those police just firing those innocent, non-lethal weapons are scaring that crowd. An important point, tear gas is extremely effective. I'm not sure if there is tear gas there. There seems to be some cloud of something floating there. Tear gas is very effective. Very. And all these non-lethal weapons are like old stuff, old hat. This has been around for long, long periods of time. None of this is new. Now we get back to the film footage where you see the police Nyala fleeing and the crowd rushing forward. But notice behind the Nyala is that rhino. I think it's a rhino. And the rhino's just sitting there. The rhino's not fleeing. So it looks like the crowd is winning, but the Nyala's just getting out of the way. And I think that's because the rhino might be the vehicle that's got the water cannon. But look at this again. It looks a little bit like the blacks are winning. Of course, they've been causing mayhem. The streets are filled with garbage and the whole place is a mess. But there's no real indication here that the police are in any danger at all. In that last piece of film footage there, you saw that somebody's filming from a vehicle and they are looking on a Nyala in front of them. And it also seems to be a slightly different location in the city. It could be that this film footage is from the Rhino, the vehicle with the water cannon. We'll see more of that later. In the next piece of film footage, what you're going to see is film footage that appears to be from the rhino, which is running the water cannon. And near the end of the film footage, you'll even hear them talk in Afrikaans. It seems to me there are white Afrikaans guys running this machine as well. You'll also see that there are sometimes black policemen, they've got blue trousers, black policemen with weapons behind a Nyala. And you'll also see these black policemen retreating. But otherwise, this particular vehicle just stands still, and you'll see that they're all quite calm about everything. and you'll see the water cannon blasting away in different directions. So if you watched carefully there, you'd have seen from the film footage that that vehicle is surrounded almost on three sides by large numbers of blacks. Notice how the blacks are standing far away from the vehicle. They're not advancing. That vehicle is sitting at an intersection. It can direct its fire in any direction, its water cannon in any direction. Those blacks are not advancing on that thing. Those blacks are not advancing on that thing. The white male's technology is working absolutely perfectly. In this bit of film footage, you're going to see what went out on South African TV. And now we'll finally get to the bottom of this. And in here, you'll see this Indian. North Americans would refer to this guy as an East Indian. This East Indian is busy talking to the police chief, who's a black guy. You can see his image there on the left of the screen. And he explains what this whole thing is about. And you'll hear this East Indian liberal give his liberal viewpoint on what happened. And you'll hear the endless moaning and groaning liberal style of what actually took place. Oh, and the police this and the police that. Now, the really interesting part about this is that the police chief talks about removing the police from there in order to stop more casualties. And he's suggesting that there could be more casualties and damage on the black side. This could well be true because these blacks are pelting things. There are cars all over the show. That may or may not be true, but anyway, it's not a big deal because we're going to get down into more important issues. What is really important in this discussion, though, is why are these blacks doing this? These blacks are not doing this to attack whites per se. What this is really about, and this is where it gets good, is you've got blacks. They say these blacks are mostly from other countries. That's possible. And all these blacks who are from other countries, they are here trying to make a living in the streets of Johannesburg by trading and selling things. So there are blacks from other parts of Africa, especially Zimbabwe, sitting here in Johannesburg, and they can't make a living. They can't make a living in their own country because their own country has already collapsed. So now they're running to the last country that's got any semblance of order and civilization, and they are coming here and they're trying to make a living here. There are millions of them who've come here, always coming to where there's order. And The only way that they can make a living is because the black government in South Africa can't create jobs for the blacks here, and they definitely cannot create jobs for the other blacks from other parts of Africa. So you've got all of black dysfunctionality right in front of your face, okay? All of this, everything that you're seeing here, is the result of black dysfunctionality by white standards. By white standards, all these people are very dysfunctional. They're dysfunctional in their own countries. They flee their own countries to come to another country. And in the other country, which is also under black rule, it's also becoming dysfunctional. So these blacks are here, and how are they making a living? Well, they make a living by standing on the sidewalks, and they've got little stalls, and they sell things. So what are they selling? Well, it turns out that they are getting counterfeit goods. Now, they don't tell you this here, but the counterfeit goods come from India and China and Asian places. Okay? These blacks are selling all kinds of counterfeit goods that is way cheaper than the original Western product. But of course, in the West, it's also not owned by the whites, it's owned by Jews and elite and assorted liberal scum. So what is actually happening here, how this actual scene transpired, is the following. It is that these liberals and Jews, liberal and Jew globalists, who have the copyright on these products, have gone to the South African government and they've said to them, listen, on the streets of your major city, you've got all these large numbers of traders, most of them foreign nationals, and they are selling goods that are taking money out of our pockets. You need to go and take care of them. Stop them selling the counterfeit goods. And when the police went to go and tell these blacks, listen, you got to stop selling these counterfeit goods. This is the only form of income these blacks have. And whether they were organized by the EFF or the Communist Party or whatever, these blacks came and they fought for their livelihood. Their livelihood is to trade in counterfeit things that come from India, that come from Asia, that come from China, counterfeit goods that are cheaper than the stuff owned by the Jews and the liberals in the Western world. Do I care? I don't care. Let the blacks sell as many counterfeit goods as they want to. They're selling cheap rubbish to their own people. That's fine. They're not putting money in the pockets of the Jews and the liberal elite. They're not putting money in the pockets of the global elite. So what are we to worry about? Why would we want to see the super rich getting even more money? These blacks are not able to function with the super rich. And now that government finds itself between a rock and a hard place. And the black government now has to try and please their globalist supporters. But it puts them in conflict with the blacks. And for whites just sitting here, it's win-win all the way. We are not part of this. This has got nothing to do with us. This is dysfunctionality between blacks in this country, blacks in other countries, Asians versus Jewish and liberal elite globalists. This has got absolutely nothing to do with us. And it's totally chaotic. And I say it's great because this does not in any way, shape or form affect the whites in a negative way. Let the blacks sell the goods from the Asians. Who cares? Who cares if the Asians are making counterfeit goods? They're not putting money in the pockets of the elite and the super rich who are busy screwing the rest of the whites in the Western world and who definitely do not do anything for the whites in South Africa. So as far as I'm concerned, I couldn't care less. All of what you're watching is black dysfunctionality, and you're watching a breakdown between globalists, between the globalists and the, the globalist Jews and liberals and their black buddies. And the blacks have got breakdown among themselves. All of it good for white people. We couldn't care less. And we shouldn't even involve ourselves in any of this. So anyway, you're going to listen to a 4.5 minute video where this East Indian talks to the police chief. Then we're going to get down into solutions. How do you actually face this if you're a normal white and if blacks came at us with mass tactics? What do we do?
Joint operation between the SAPS and Johannesburg Metro Police has turned violent this morning. Quite clearly, law enforcement authorities were clamping down on counterfeit goods in the city. Vendors turned on police who were outnumbered. Police in turn then firing rubber bullets at protesters. Calm apparently has now been restored, but we are keeping a close eye on the situation. And actually, let's get more now from police spokesperson Kay Makubele. Thanks for your time, sir. We appreciate it. What went wrong? You were overpowered.
The problem indeed was the overcrowding of the people who prevent the police to do their work. However, we had managed to use rubber bullets to try to disperse them. And during the protest, there were three people who were injured and taken to hospital. We also found out that our vehicles from the metro were damaged, as well as the Nyala, because they throw petrol bombs to the vehicle. So far, we will continue to conduct operations and enforce the law of this country. Those who resist, they will know that this country have got law, and we are going to make sure that they are going to be arrested.
It doesn't look like you carried out this operation in a very smart way, given that vendors actually managed to overpower your officers and make them turn around.
It may not be calculated very well, as they went to a place where they have kept all their things, which they believe is a big market. That's why they resist when they saw the police to coming so that they can confiscate all those goods. However, that won't stop the police to do their job, and we are going to enforce the law to make sure that those things which are here illegally are confiscated.
All right, so your officers left the scene there, as we see in that video. Did they not try to go back today, or will you try another time where you actually have more personnel on the ground to do what you were trying to do?
Yes, the police had to retrieve to avoid more injuries, as they've realized that there were other people who were getting injured during the shooting of the rubber bullets. They had to go to reverse. To make sure that proper planning and making sure that those who are involved in criminal activities are going to be made, and we are going to go back and make sure that those people are arrested.
Hey, forgive me for being funny about this. Actually, I'm not being funny. It's quite embarrassing for the police, because you speak to me now very confidently saying you're going to crack down on these criminals, but this visual is telling me something else. When are you going back to these vendors to confiscate these counterfeit goods?
Look, we don't say when we're going to conduct our duty. We know that they did what they did. It's upon us to make sure that as soon as we can, we go back and make sure that those goods are confiscated.
All right, and you'll go back with all the personnel you need and hopefully get the job done next time. Try again.
We are going to make sure that those people are arrested. We have seen what happened. We have seen that they have damaged other cars during that protest, and we have seen that they have disturbed the people on the street by barricading the roads, and that cannot be tolerated. We are going to make sure that those people are arrested.
Right. Shame, guys. All right, thanks for that. Appreciate it. K. Makubele.
So I was wrong when I said the black police chief. I meant the black police spokesman. So you heard what was said, and they have to go back. So the government of South Africa, the black government, has to go and do the bidding of the super rich. And they're caught between a rock and a hard place. The whole thing is not working so well. And that's not our problem. And they've got to go back and they've got to go and find these blacks. And they're also talking about criminal elements. Yeah. That's all part and parcel of this black setup in the Central Business District. This is how dysfunctional it has become. This is a rerun of Nigeria and lots of black cities in Africa. And it's got nothing to do with us whites. Nor does it matter to us how this thing is resolved. The point is, it's got nothing to do with us. Let's start looking at solutions. Let's start looking at our history. Facing large numbers of people in a crowd is nothing new. Facing masses of people trying to attack you is nothing new. White men have been dealing with this for thousands of years. And I'm going to show you how Napoleon dealt with an even bigger threat, a much bigger threat than this, with 200-year-old technology. How well does the white man's technology work? There's this quote from Napoleon called, "The best medicine against the grapes of wrath is a whiff of grape shot." And what we're going to look at is a massive crowd, but it's not just any crowd. This is actually a sort of patriotic army formed by the English during the French Revolution. The English shipped about 80,000 muskets to an army that was going to fight against the new government of revolutionary France. And Napoleon was a young general in that army at that time. Napoleon had his first military success by this time. Napoleon's very first military success was actually against the British Navy in the harbour at Toulon. The British Navy actually controlled the harbour, and the British controlled part of this port city in France. And the French had been struggling for a long time to evict the British from their own port. And it was young Napoleon who came up with an idea. And Napoleon showed other officers and other people his idea for how they could drive the French fleet out of their own harbor. And eventually people liked this idea and it got the go-ahead. And it was Napoleon's very first battle. And he won. He also got injured in the battle. He was physically injured in the battle, but he was fine otherwise, and he won. It was his very first victory, and it was a big moment because the French had managed to drive the British out of their port, and they'd managed to drive the powerful English Navy out of their harbour, and it was all due to the tactics and strategy of Napoleon. So Napoleon was now a figure who'd been known for this event, which had taken place, I think about 2 years before. And Napoleon was in Paris. And that's what we're going to study here. So the English were busy arming up another army and turning Frenchmen against Frenchmen. Very Jewish kind of behavior. And this army went into Paris. And this army was going to attempt to overthrow the government. Napoleon happened to be in Paris at the time, And Napoleon was quickly called in to be among the French officers who were going to be part of this resistance, because the British were on the verge of overthrowing the government. So Napoleon was then called in, and he immediately came up with his own idea. And he was supposed to work with another Frenchman, but Napoleon insisted that either he has his way by himself or nothing. And this is another lesson from warfare, which I will be returning to. The power of one. The power of one, when one man gets to make decisions. One man who knows what he's doing and he makes decisions and what comes out of it. It's going to astound you. It is a very much a white European thing. It's very much part of our race. And it comes from our unbelievably long experience in warfare. So Napoleon insisted that he take command. He wasn't going to share command. He wasn't going to argue with anybody. So technically it was him and another guy, but in practice the other guy just backed down and let Napoleon do what he wanted to do. Now, a whiff of grape shot is basically, grape shot is a type of, it's almost a case of taking a cannon and turning it into a shotgun. And they packed grape shot into the cannon, and the grape shot was actually consisted of like balls, almost like musket balls. I think they might have been bigger in size, but basically they pack the grape shot into the cannon and the cannon turns into a shotgun. And remember, of course, these cannons take a long time to load and prepare, and you need a skill, you need a whole crew in order to make this thing function. So there's a lot of technical stuff that goes into this, but Napoleon was, his speciality was artillery. And he looked at this situation and he said artillery could do this. We are talking more than 200 years ago. But White's already had technology to deal with this kind of thing. So we're going to look more closely at the Battle of Vendemiaire and the whiff of grape shot and what it did. On Wikipedia, you can see these statistics here showing this battle that occurred between Napoleon and the French royalists in 1795. As you can see, Napoleon had 6,000 men, 4,500 were regular troops, and the other 1,500 were probably what you could call militia. The English had armed an army of 30,000, and this army of 30,000 men with muskets was coming also with civilians intermingling with them. And this huge number of people tried to drive their way by force into the streets of Paris to get to the government and to overthrow it. And Napoleon went and he got Murat to go and grab some cannons that he thought might be available. They grabbed the cannons, he positioned them, he worked out the tactics. And what ensued was this battle in the streets of Paris. And these cannons were firing grape shot. And if you look at the bottom, you can get an idea of the casualties. The French suffered 100 dead and wounded. So it's a bit of a mixture there. The royalists suffered at least 300 dead in the actual fighting. And it looks as if there were 400 civilians, I assume killed. I'm not sure if the 400 is civilians killed and injured or just killed. But you can see that Napoleon was outnumbered 5-1. He was outnumbered 5-1, and he was holding on to these streets against this massive group of people. And these people were not throwing half bricks. These people were whites who were armed. And look at the end result. 300 dead, 300 dead of this invading army. 400 civilians dead, or maybe dead and injured, and game over. So you can see large numbers of people fighting in streets, coming in overwhelming numbers with weapons, trying to frontally assault an army 220 years ago. And the small army, using proper tactics and their cannons, put that big army in its place, outnumbered 5-1, stopped them dead in their tracks. And there you have it. So that will give you an idea. That's just a small idea of fighting in a city. And if you go into modern times and you start studying other wars, you start studying World War II, you start studying other wars, you will see that these people like Gustav Müller and Simon Roche, who are constantly telling you everyone's going to die in the city, get out of the city, the prophecies say everyone's going to die, that runs completely contrary to logic. It runs completely contrary to military experience, runs completely contrary to the white race's experience. Absolute nonsense, total rubbish. You can fight in a city. You can fight in a city outnumbered, and you can easily defend yourself. In fact, the city becomes part of your defense. And if you even look back at that film footage of earlier where you had the blacks with the half bricks, what did you see? When the police climbed out of their vehicles, the police went into buildings and they stayed inside buildings and popped out through the doors and were shooting at the blacks. The buildings are acting as protection. So that is how this thing really works. A city is really a kind of a fortress. But you have fools and idiots wanting you to believe that a city is not a good place to fight. These people know nothing about military history. Absolutely nothing. And if you go back to even more ancient times, to the times of the Romans and others, you will see lots of examples of cities being attacked, fighting in cities, how defensible cities were. Cities used to be so hard to get into that you could surround a city and put it under siege. Sometimes for years, you would struggle to get into a city. If the city had enough food supply, the people could stay inside the city for years. And this is before aircraft. There's no way to resupply them, yet they could function like this. A city can be a place that protects you. Buildings can be wonderful protection. And you've got all kinds of fools and idiots wanting you to believe that you're just going to be wiped out in a city. No, no, no. The whole strategy and tactics of cities and towns is very important. And to go and to talk all kinds of rubbish and nonsense, one could go through many, many examples. We could sit here for a week going through dozens, if not hundreds, of examples of cities being defended and holding entire armies at bay for long periods of time. So what follows is a bit of film footage from a movie that was made a few years ago showing this event. And it's quite good film footage. It'll give you a little bit of an idea. But what Napoleon was facing, and he was very outnumbered, he was facing something really serious, and yet his cannons made mincemeat of the people. So you'll see this little video, but we're going to get on to more realistic stuff relating to South Africa, and we're going to see film footage from South Africa as well.
And this is the area that concerns me most, the Rue Saint-Honoré and the Palais Égalité. If the rebels descend on us,
General,
from Saint-Roch,
another good reason to act. Believe me, Barras, we cannot let a simple riot...
A simple riot? Is that what you call 25,000 royalists storming the assembly to seize the deputies and destroy the republic?
What forces do you have?
Your name again?
General Bonaparte, currently with our command.
Ah, Bonaparte. Artillery, wasn't it? Right then. We have 4,000 men from the camp at Sablon under General Menou. 4,000 against 25,000.
No cannons?
General Menou led them in Sablon with the excuse that they would slow him down.
We need that artillery. Tell squadron leader Murat to retrieve those cannons. He's a human tidal wave. Nothing can stand in his way. At the moment, we have the artillery. We will position it like this. One battery here, another one here, another one on this bridge in line, and another one here.
If the cannons come through, you'll take command of them.
I warn you, citizen, that I follow a pledge to its end or mine. Don't ask me to answer for any blood that's shed. If I draw my sword, it will remain drawn until the order of the Republic is restored.
What is the date?
It's midnight. So it's now the 13th of Vendémiaire.
Your appointment as chief of staff. It's up to you now.
This is war.
War? In the streets of Paris? Against Frenchmen?
Against royalists, who are in league with the enemies of the nation. There are 40 English vessels off the coast of Brest, and 40,000 Austrians at the gates of Strasbourg. They are waiting for the Republic to be overthrown. They are waiting to invade France. It will not happen. Our general of the Republic, and I will not let it.
Thank you.
From our little study of history, you can see that technology, the white man's technology, more than 220 years old, worked fine in a city against massed attacks. People outnumbered in massed attacks. These weren't blacks attacking them with spears. These were whites with muskets, as well as other civilians mixed in, and they were trying to use their weight of numbers against a small French army contingent. And Napoleon won. And he won despite being tremendously outnumbered in a city. And you have Gustav Müller, you've got Simon Roche. All of them are telling you that according to prophecy, white people are going to be slaughtered inside cities, that you must leave a city, that you're going to die in a city. This stuff works completely and utterly against all military history logic in the history of our race. People have been defending cities with bows and arrows, with swords and shields, and they've been defending them very well. Cities make for good defensive positions. And fighting in streets is something that our race has been doing for thousands of years. And we did it with everything from catapults and swords right up to here we see Napoleon with cannons. And it just gets better and better. So fighting in city streets, fighting between buildings, this is old hat for our race. We've been doing this for a long time, and it's not that difficult to win. In fact, those city streets and those buildings become very useful if you stick to normal military strategy and tactics. So, we're going to start taking a look at South Africa in recent times. We're going to start looking at film footage. And what can we learn from apartheid times and other times when there was violence? Because this country has not just seen violence once. In this country, there have been probably tens of thousands of riots and strikes in this country at the very least. If not more than tens of thousands. This is a game that's been played out in the streets of South Africa for the last 30, 40, 50, 60 years, and it's always been a rerun of this stupid nonsense. But I'm going to show you how whites used to deal with these things. We're going to get closer and closer to reality. Take a look at a short bit of film footage. The apartheid police in action against a crowd of people, which includes multiracial whites, and you've got students and women, and they're all busy now trying to stand up to the whites. Now take a good look. You're going to see some white policemen. They've not got advanced weapons. You'll see some of them have got head protection. So nobody's going to get injured on the head. And they don't even have special protection, don't even have shields. In fact, all they have is what looks like a sjambak. A sjambak is a short whip. And it's made out of animal skin. And they just come up to these protesters with their sjambaks. And they give them a little bit of a good beating that they all thoroughly deserve. You'll see them grab a white girl there and giving her a good couple of hits and she's screaming away. And look at how that crowd starts running away. Look at what happens when a couple of white males, just with sjambaks, starts taking on a liberal crowd. And look at them and see how they start running away. Low-tech weaponry, some tactics, and a few practiced white males. Just showing you who's boss.
Oh.
There you have it. From probably the 1980s, some white males, probably most if not all of them Afrikaans, showing white male domination and power in a simple way. Those women and those young whites, they're just getting a bit of a whipping. Nobody's going to walk away with scars or injuries to last a lifetime, but they're getting a little bit of a beating there, and they're screaming away, and they're very uncomfortable, and it's a good beating that they thoroughly deserve. So they're getting a little bit of white male attention, where the white male kicks everybody into line, and the white male shows his physical domination. He shows, I'm the boss. And there's a lot of screaming and a lot of running. And this is all the result of a bit of low-tech stuff, okay? This is low-tech. Just the white male coming out, just gnawing a little bit here and there, just scaring everybody and showing them, I'm still the boss, I'm here. And this is what, 20, 30 years ago? Not long ago. The white male was absolutely dominant in this country. And this country needs a lot more of this kind of attention. So, just to show you, it's real simple. And look at how outnumbered they are. Blacks, did you see all the blacks that were running away? And the white girls getting a good bit of a scream there for being on the wrong side. Yep. So, some good white male stuff. I must add that this particular demonstration took place in Cape Town, liberal Cape Town, back then. So these are some Cape whites and blacks getting a good beating. And for those of you who are overseas, take this as a lesson. This is how you treat a liberal and a Jew properly. This is how you actually treat them. You need to go and grab them, give them a little bit of a good beating, and it'll do them good. It'll help to clear their heads. And you'll see, look at the blacks running away. No guns, no machine guns, but the white man is still dominant and in charge. Large and in charge. There is a certain mythology that people have begun to believe, even in South Africa. And this mythology is the result of simply the tactics of the time. The mythology is that large numbers of blacks can get together, they are some kind of threat, and they are to be feared, and not many people die. This is the result of the government of the day actually going out of its way to not kill large numbers of blacks. Killing large numbers of blacks, when you got a large number of people packed together, packed tightly together, it is easy to kill them. This is a military fact that has been true for hundreds and thousands of years. And if you look at the way that warfare has evolved, there are military officers who have stated that the reason that armies are more and more spread out over time is a direct result of increased firepower. Armies used to gather together, an entire army of like 100,000 men could gather together in a couple of miles. They could stand physically next to each other. And that was fine in the days of bows and arrows and pikes and swords, because that worked the best. It worked best when they were fighting together. But as gunpowder came and missile weapons came, missiles being cannons and muskets and things, the moment you started getting missile weapons, men had to start spreading further and further apart. As these weapons became more dangerous, soldiers had to move further and further apart because a single cannon or a single shell could kill large numbers of troops. And that is why over time you will see that armies have become more and more spread out. However, the blacks of South Africa pack themselves together tightly in large groups. And now people look at that large group packed shoulder to shoulder and they say, oh goodness, they're going to kill us. But actually, they are easier to kill in that state than in any other state. Them packing themselves together doesn't make them invincible. It makes them more vulnerable. And there is a whole video that I did about how the Boers dealt with violent crowds through decapitation in the time of apartheid. And my friend Gilbert, who passed away in America in 2012, my friend Gilbert actually told me how things happened when he was a young man in the army, how they actually controlled a crowd. And they would control an entire crowd just by killing the leaders one by one. And the whole crowd would become quiet. And they did this in a very clever, systematic way so that there were not large numbers of black casualties. Furthermore, the government of the time went to great lengths to try and find non-lethal ways to control crowds. You've got water cannons, you've got tear gas, and they even looked at other things like sound, like knocking people out using nothing but sound. They went and experimented in all sorts of ways of making a crowd, of rendering a crowd incapacitated without actually physically killing them. And now, because the government of that time went to great extremes to not kill black people, and what few black people they did kill and had to kill and truly had to be killed, they then got criticized for. The fact of the matter is that people think that crowds in South Africa, black crowds, are something of a threat, and they are not. They are not. In military terms, if you want to kill these people, it's easier than ever. And even if you had an army coming at you, every one of them armed with an AK-47, and they were packed shoulder to shoulder, you would kill them easily. If they were to attack you, they would have to spread out in order to stay alive. That is the military fact of how crowds and density works. I'm going to show you a piece of film footage now. This is one of the rare occasions where the whites decided to just go and kill who needed to be killed. And this thing is called Operation Trojan Horse. And what happened was that there was a CBS camera crew in a township in Cape Town in the time of apartheid, and they were standing around and they were filming and they had no idea what was about to happen. And they actually stumbled on an action where the police had decided to lay a trap. Now, you got to listen to these liberal journalists who are merely stating what they are paid to state. So it's not factual, it's just their nonsense liberal talk. And they go on and on, oh, you see, there was this police brutality back then. And they talk about the kids. What they don't tell you is that the African National Congress went out of its way to get the youngsters to start rebelling against the system and get involved in the revolution against the whites. The ANC used to have slogans like liberation before education. Yeah? and there are millions of blacks who took part in these things. So when they talk about, oh, these kids are being taught by the ANC to cause trouble, to kill people, to harm property. These are not just innocent little kids. These are gangs. Even Nelson Mandela's own wife, Winnie Mandela, was involved with a gang that used to kidnap people and murder people. So when these liberal, lying whites are busy saying to you, oh, you see, these are just children, they're just innocent, bull dust, okay? That's already big nonsense right there. So I'm going to leave the film footage so that you can hear all these scumbag, liberal, useless pieces of rubbish telling their full story, but just keep in mind that it's completely twisted out of context with the time. So what actually happens here is that this is one of the very rare occasions, and the only one caught on film, the only one of a number caught on film, where the whites decide it's time to kill somebody. And the way they do it is very simple. You see a truck driving up and down a road, and this truck has got some what appears to be metal sheeting on its sides, but otherwise it just looks like a normal truck. And this truck is driving past a bunch of kids. These are not kids, these are young communist revolutionaries. They've been indoctrinated and they are busy causing trouble in the area. And this truck is driving up and down and it passes these innocent kids. And then these innocent kids suddenly start throwing half bricks at the truck. And they actually start shattering the windscreen. However, they're in for a bit of a surprise, because in the back of the truck, hiding behind those steel plates, are five white policemen armed with small shotguns. These actually look a lot like the 410 shotgun that my dad used to have. I used to like the little 410 shotgun, and it's a pump action and it can take five rounds. So it's not like it's got a big magazine. So you see these policemen jump up with what appears to be with 410 shotguns, and they start actually shooting at the, quotes, kids, okay? Little communist revolutionary scum. And they kill a bunch of them. And you're going to see how simple this is done. Very simple. A truck, some steel plates on it, doesn't look out of place, doesn't look very high tech. And it catches them and kills a bunch of them. So watch this film footage and just listen to all the liberal whining about the time. Oh yes, and you're going to see Pik Botha, the foreign minister of South Africa of that time. And you can see the useless bastard, how he says, oh, you know, this was so bad and made us look so, you know, man up, man, and defend your country, for goodness sake, you useless bastard. Anyway, here is the film footage, Operation Trojan Horse.
Finally tonight, the apartheid regime Nelson Mandela fought to overturn often resorted to violent extremes to protect its power. A CBS News report nearly three decades ago exposed one brutal government tactic, leading to the prompt expulsion of correspondent Alan Pizzi and two other CBS News employees. The report provoked outrage around the world. Alan Pizzi tonight looks back on the Trojan horse.
Nothing will happen here if you people leave.
You people were the foreign press. The white South African regime often accused the media of instigating the violence that was filmed when I was reporting from the country in 1985. But on October 15th of that year, two CBS News camera crews would capture a police operation which no one except the perpetrators could possibly have known about in advance.
So it's a bit dodgy right now.
When cameraman Chris Everson and soundman Nick Delacanza arrived in Thornton Road in a mixed-race suburb outside Cape Town, there was no more violence than usual. but it would escalate into an event that many said did more damage to the South African regime's international image than all the other coverage combined.
There was a bunch of kids standing on a street corner, probably about 30 strong. Clearly there had been some incidents already. There were signs that vehicles had been stoned, there was glass on the street. And not wanting to be part of the scene, we set ourselves well back from it.
Just up the road but out of sight, CBS cameraman Fim DeVos and sound recordist Anton van der Merwe, no strangers to police harassment, arrived on the scene.
It wasn't violent at that point when I arrived there, but I could see the rocks in their hands. I wasn't that far away from it. I thought, uh-oh, there comes trouble.
Chris Everson had the same gut feeling.
It was a flatbed vehicle with boxes on the back. And I filmed the truck as it went down the road away from me towards the group of kids on the corner.
Then the truck turned around and came back.
As it approached the kids, three or four stones hit the windscreen.
And as they did so, there were several policemen in the back of the truck, hiding in boxes, and they popped up.
One stunned youngster froze and watched the horror unfold. Back in 1985, we had no idea that the police had labeled their operation Ghost Vehicle. When I wrote the story that day, I called it a deadly Trojan horse. Three kids were killed, the youngest was 11 years old, and 12 were injured, among them two children who were hit in their own homes.
The strange thing was, you know, at the time, we didn't even realize the importance of what we had just photographed.
And neither did the police. When they finally forced the camera crews to leave the area, they failed to confiscate the videotapes, and the damage was done.
Of course, it was one of those very ugly events that did us a lot of harm.
At the time, Roelof Pikbuta was the South African foreign minister.
It was extremely harmful for us in foreign affairs because that increased the negative reaction overseas and affected and expanding economic sanctions against South Africa.
Worldwide condemnation of South Africa was almost immediate, and so was the white government's reaction. Within days of the shooting, the state of emergency was expanded. Journalists were prohibited from filming any incident of police violence under the threat of 10 years of imprisonment.
What was new about this event was that there was a camera there. These events, these killings, this police brutality, this happened all the time in South Africa.
Thornton Road today is a far cry from what it was like 28 years ago, except for a steel memorial, a grim reminder of the day three young South Africans were gunned down from that deadly Trojan horse.
As usual, the liberal journalists are telling you, the violence from the whites. But they don't talk about the violence from the blacks. They don't talk about the fact that these youngsters had been stoning vehicles, had been smashing vehicles. Oh, that apparently is nothing. The real issue is police brutality. And of course, the other thing is they never tell you about the people that these ANC scum are murdering. They don't tell you about the people that are being murdered, necklaced, stabbed to death, shot. They don't talk about that. Very one-sided. A liberal only tells half the truth, and then he leaves out the most important part.